This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Before the internet, you would just sit in an armchair with a book open on your lap, staring into space. Or you'd quietly start sketching something in a notebook, not sure what it was, but you'd let inspiration guide you, and then, whoop, turns out you'd drawn a squiggly alligator.
You're listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Before the internet, you'd have yawning summer afternoons, when you'd flop down on one couch, then flop down on another, then decide to craft a fake FBI card. You get some paper from your dad's office, copy the FBI logo and your signature, laminate it with scotch tape, put it in your wallet, take it out of your wallet, look at it, then put it back in your wallet with a secretive smile. It was a heady time. You'd be in some kind of art center, wearing roomy overalls, looking at a tray of precious gems, and you'd say, "That's cat's eye." And your friend would say, "No, that's opal." And you'd say, "That's definitely cat's eye." And there would be no way to look it up, except if someone had a little booklet. "Anyone got a little booklet?" you'd ask, looking around. "Is there a booklet on this shit?" Then you'd walk outside and squint at the sky, just you in your body, not tethered to any network, adrift by yourself in a world of strangers in the sunlight. Before the internet, if you were in need of some facts, you might actually decide to consult an old person, like the one living in your finished basement. But then you'd find yourself watching the bridge on the River Kwai, which you agreed to do because the old person asked in such a fragile way that you couldn't say no. About 10 minutes in, you'd say you needed some water, then wander up to the kitchen where you'd get caught up staring at a refrigerator magnet. Then, for no reason, you'd do a little dance. "Maybe I'll direct music videos," you'd say to yourself. But you'd have no way to look up how to do that. You'd just be standing in the deafening quiet of your kitchen at midday, alone with your thoughts. "Should I test out these pens on this turquoise pad?" you'd ask yourself, staring at some pens by the phone. Instead, you'd take a sip of your drink and say, "Ah," like a person in a commercial. And then you'd go do that in front of a mirror to see how it looked. Because that's what it was like before the internet. You made your own fun.
Before the internet, remember? Halcyon Days. That's a piece by Emma Rathbone, performed for us by Jenny Slate. I'm David Remnick, and this is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
At 94 years of age, I'm blind in my right eye, deaf in my left ear, have a broken hip, but I have to tell you, origami is the best medicine. I never take a painkiller. All I do is take a piece of paper and I get very absorbed. And depending
earlier this summer, the Origami USA convention was held here in New York at St. John's College in Queens. Hundreds of aficionados gathered to talk shop and learn new designs for folding paper bugs, birds, furniture, even a trombone.
I play the trombone, and so I designed an origami trombone with a moving slide. And so, you know, I'm going to be teaching that here at the convention. It's a complex level design.
An origami trombone. Couldn't resist, so we sent staff writer Susan Orlean to cover the convention. Now, Susan jokes that her beat for The New Yorker has always been maniacs. She's written about umbrella inventors, about two guys who impersonated a Twitter bot. Long story. And she also wrote an epic story about an orchid thief that became the basis for the movie Adaptation. Here's Susan Orlean.
I always love reading about and writing about people who are inordinately passionate about something, which is kind of a nicer way of saying people who are obsessed. So, of course, I love origami people. But I went to the convention to see one origami person in particular, a Caltech-trained physicist named Robert Lang. Robert had been doing cutting-edge research in lasers, but then at the peak of his career in physics, he gave it up to become a professional origami artist. Every origami fan at the convention wanted to be in a class with Robert. He's the Da Vinci of origami. Maybe he's the Obi-Wan Kenobi of origami. Maybe he's the Secretariat of origami. He was teaching a session on a model of his called the Taiwan Goldfish. It's Opus 716 in the oeuvre of Robert Lang.
This is Robert Lang. He's going to be presenting his Taiwan Goldfish. Thank you, Robert.
You're welcome. So are we ready to go? Okay. I'd already told the folks here we're using 10-inch foil-backed paper. American foil, alu foil.
Over the years, Robert has folded flat sheets of paper into an unimaginable array of things, including rhinoceroses, cuckoo clocks, unicorns, nearly every kind of beetle known to mankind, and in one of his most famous demonstrations, the head of Drew Carey.
There was a plot line where Drew Carey took up origami, and they said, well, we want him to fold a big origami model of himself, so would you fold a life-size Drew Carey? Which I did, but they rewrote that out of the script, so it never made it to air, which is sort of too bad.
Now, I am the lowest level of origami artist. In fact, I really shouldn't even dignify myself by calling myself an artist. I like folding paper. Normally, I would not be the target audience for Robert's class.
So, let's get started. And we're going to start with the color up and fold the paper in half from edge to edge.
This was step-by-step instruction on how to fold Robert's Taiwan goldfish. It's this really beautiful creature with a hinged mouth, a long, elegant tail, and all the proper goldfish fins trailing off in a kind of poetic way. And it's really hard. So hang on, don't go so fast.
And bring it back.
So I cheated. I was sitting next to a friend of Robert's, another professional origami artist, and he kept leaning over and helping me fix my mistakes.
Here's where we were. I'm gonna bring this raw edge to line up with a diagonal existing crease. As I do that, I'll have to make a squash fold of the layers in between, squash that, and flatten.
I have a little bit of a flaw. What's wrong here?
There's a little close-up. There's the crease. Fold it over, and I squash fold the little hood, and then press it flat.
There is a problem.
And we're ready for our next step.
I mean,
the next step is going to be...
Origami is an ancient art form that nobody would ever describe as a growth industry. But we're also now recognizing that it has enormous technological potential. In fact, in 2012, the National Science Foundation awarded millions of dollars for research into the scientific applications of folding.
And this gave a huge jump start to the field. There have been all of these applications that people have demonstrated using origami and solar arrays and airbags and telescopes and things like this. And this is something.
One of the really cool ways origami is being used now is as a foldable Kevlar bulletproof barrier for police to use.
So it's 12 layers of Kevlar, and you grab it and it unfolds and creates this sort of arc-shaped barrier. Because it's folded from one sheet with no seams, there are no weak places.
There are also breakthroughs in origami that are pretty extraordinary and very experimental, like the recent development of the world's tiniest origami bird.
It's about 400 microns long, about 5 human hair widths in size, and this was done with photolithography and chemistry to induce the paper to fold itself into the bird.
That's amazing. You know, obviously nobody can look at a bird that big and say, oh, you know, look at this. I mean, it's too small
You need a microscope to make out the bird.
Yeah, so partly you're doing it for the physics of learning how to make something like that happen.
Yeah, there's no actual application for a bird, but the technology of creating self-folding microscopic paper has applications, particularly in making medical devices. Microscopic machines that can sort cells or, you know, can go crush a cancer cell but leave non-cancer cells alone and things like that. But when you're demonstrating milestones along the way, you pick something that looks fun and cool. The next step is going to be a crimp. Crimp is
deformed
valley.
Goldfish.
The mountain exists. The mountain fold is this vertical crease that we made early on. The valley fold's going to run out in this.
Is there something innate that would make someone good at origami as opposed to just being studious?
It's hard to put a finger on precisely what it is. But to be really good at origami, you need to be able to visualize what the paper's doing and visualize kind of what's going on inside a stack of layers.
You know what I just thought of? This might be ridiculous, but I wonder if people who are good at origami would also be good at cutting hair, because it's three-dimensional and it's lots of layers. And I have to research that. But it's just,
it's, I don't know any hair cutters who come to the convention.
I'm drawing this connection because I'm really bad at cutting hair, much as I always love to cut, like, my boyfriend's hair. And I'm also quite bad at origami. And so I think there's a connection.
Now, in origami, if we mess up, we throw it away, grab a new sheet of paper. You have to have a little more care and precision when you're cutting someone's hair.
You get a new boyfriend, which is what I
just
did.
Get a new person. Here's a little bit stretched out. You can see this side is half of a reverse fold. Gonna do the same thing on the other side.
I should have had more coffee. I remember when we first met, you said something to me that I've never forgotten, that paper has a memory, that once you fold it, you can never entirely remove the fold. Am I remembering this right?
Yeah, once you made it, you folded it, the paper has a memory because the fibers and the bonds between the fibers are permanently changed, and so it'll always know that fold.
Well, it's funny because it's something that I think about often, because there's something kind of profound about it. It seems like it's kind of about life too.
Yeah, the engineers have a way of, you know, reducing a profound concept to a technical term. It undergoes plastic deformation. It just means a permanent change. And lots of materials do that as well. If you take a sheet of metal and you fold it and then you try to unfold it, you'll be left with a little divot that you can't really get rid of. But paper, yes, it remembers that fold, but then it's also happy to fold the other direction. And that is unusual.
It's really cute.
And the very last regular fold, I'm going to open it out and reverse fold it forward so that, there we go, you get a mouth. That is the mouth.
That is.
And once you have the mouth, then you can put your fingers inside, round the body, and bring the fins out. That's our finished goldfish. And our visitor was successful, it looks like, so.
Well, with a little help.
Staff writer Susan Orlean with the origami legend Robert Lang. And that's it for the New Yorker Radio Hour this week. I'm David Remnick. Thanks for joining me. Next week will be our 100th episode. 100. Who knew? Talk to you then.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, David Krasnow, Sarah Nix, Michael Raphael, Mythili Rao, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Susan Morrison, Emma Allen, Terrence Bernardo, Sarah Sandbach, and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.